Hello there, and welcome to The Blender, the weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. My name is Pavel Butorin, and I'll be your host this week. On this show, to mark the 25th anniversary of the Chernobyl nuclear disaster, Natalia Churikova of our Ukrainian service tells us of her experiences as a young girl in Kyiv in 1986, after she and her family first learned of the disaster at the nearby nuclear power plant.
People were panicking. I've heard stories of people sending their children, packing them away into the trains with notes that, "Here is the name of my kid, please take care of him."
We'll talk to Gary Seymour, a top arms control advisor to U.S. President Barack Obama, about the United States' nuclear dialogue with Russia and the administration's efforts to resolve the international standoff over Iran's nuclear program.
Since Iran so far has not been willing to engage in a serious diplomatic effort, President Obama sees no choice but to try to increase the cost to Iran's leaders of its nuclear program.
And in our Meet the Blogger series, Grant Podelko, a frequent host of The Blender, talks to RFERL's chief Washington editor Christian Carl, the author of Outpost Washington, the news blog on our English-language website at referl.org.
I call it turning the telescope around. We're trying to look at the policy process and the stuff that's happening in Washington through the filter of the way our regions are thinking about things.
On April 26, 1986, the nuclear power plant at Chernobyl in the Soviet Republic of Ukraine exploded and caught fire. The resulting cloud of contamination spread radiation across large parts of Europe and Western Russia. 25 years later, Chernobyl ranks as the worst civilian nuclear disaster in history, although it's getting a run for its money by the continuing crisis at the Fukushima nuclear power plant in Japan. In 1986, Natalia Churikova, now a broadcaster at our Ukrainian service, was a carefree schoolgirl in the capital, Kyiv, until she and her family began to hear reports of a problem at the nearby nuclear power plant. Natalia talks about her experiences in a regular segment we call This Is My Story.
My name is Natalia Churikova, and I'm a broadcaster with the Ukrainian service of Radio Liberty. In April 1986, I was 14, and I was a schoolgirl in Kyiv. And it's a city of 2.5 million people. It was about 80 kilometers from Chernobyl. The morning of April the 27th, the day after the disaster, was a normal day. It was, as far as I can remember, it was Saturday, and it was a perfect day. It was very warm, very nice, and most of the people would spend their time outside. And my family wasn't an exception. We went for a nice stroll around the city and enjoyed ourselves until the evening. We were caught up by a small rain, but well, on a nice warm day, it wasn't really a big deal. But then we came home, and my stepfather got a telephone call. He was in the military at that time, and there was a conversation then, and I didn't like the conversation because he looked very worried. He came back to me and he said, "Look, we all need to take a shower." I said, "Why? I want to go to bed. I'm tired. I'm too tired to go to a shower." He said, "Look, you do need to take a shower because there was some kind of an explosion on a nuclear plant not far from Kyiv, and you need to take some kind of precaution." Well, that was the first time I heard the name of Chernobyl, and it was the first time I heard about radiation. Well, he said, "I need to go to a shower." I went to shower. And then, the next day was Sunday, and all of the people, it was before the May Day holidays, so people would spend as much time outside as they could. And, of course, no one really told them what happened. So I was trying to find out what was really happening because everyone was trying to find out. There were so many rumors around Kyiv about what was going on, but no one really knew anything. And I heard that the voices, as collectively Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, the Voice of America and BBC were called at that time, that the voices said something about the disaster in Chernobyl. So I was trying to find out on the radio if there was information, but I couldn't find anything in either Ukrainian or Russian, so I listened to, I think it was the Swedish radio in English, and they said that they registered high level of radiation in Sweden. Then I thought, oh gosh, I didn't wash my hair in vain. If they have radiation somewhere in Sweden, that's very far from Kyiv. The authorities, what they did, they were trying to conceal the whole story for as long as they could. Basically, they tried to show the world that everything was normal, and they have organized a cycling championship in Kyiv, through the whole of Kyiv. And people started already to try to escape from the city. At least they tried to take their children away. And what they do to try to make them believe that everything was under control, the then leader of the Communist Party, his name was Volodymyr Shcherbitsky, he took his grandson to the May Day parade and demonstration to persuade the people. And probably, the rumors were that his grandson was taken away just in a few hours after the parade.
You're listening to The Blender, the weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. This is the story of Natalia Churikova, a broadcaster at our Ukrainian service, about her experiences as a young girl in Kyiv, just a short distance from the Chernobyl power plant, when she and her family first learned of the nuclear disaster.
The tickets to get out of the city were completely impossible to get to. People were panicking. I've heard stories of people sending their children, packing them away into the trains with notes that here is the name of my kid, please take care of him. We were lucky because we planned before everything happened. We planned to go with my classmates and my friends to their grandparents, to a city of Ternopil, which is about 400 kilometers from Kyiv and from Chernobyl. So we had the tickets already and off we went, which was something which was planned as a long weekend. Then turned out to be like 2 or 3 weeks away from our parents, because we stayed there and they wanted us to stay there for as long as we could until something becomes clear about what we need to do. As soon as we arrived, we were taken to a medical facility to get the check of the radiation, to measure the radiation. And the clothes that we came in, they had to be disposed of because they were accumulating too much radiation. I had a beautiful blue T-shirt, acrylic T-shirt, which I had to say goodbye to because of that. And they said also, don't wear any kind of synthetic material because it accumulates more radiation than natural fabric. Then also my grandmother, she heard, well, people didn't get any information from official sources, so they collected everything from rumors, from friends, from whatever sources they could get to. So the first information about the measures of precaution was that we should be taking iodine. So she got a bottle of iodine from a pharmacy, and she would add a few drops of iodine every day to our milk. And that was believed to substitute the radioactive iodine that already was in our system and bodies. As I learned later, it was really too late to take iodine at that stage. Also, people were drinking red wine, believing that it was cleaning the system, because they have heard that Soviet submarine sailors, they were given red wine as part of their daily diet to clean the system from the radiation. But some people took it further and they just decided that any alcohol will do the job. And they just drank too much. And it was also at the time when Gorbachev had his anti-alcohol campaign, so it wasn't really very easy to get the alcohol at that time. So people were really pissed off twice because of that. Because first, they didn't get the right information. And second, if they thought that the alcohol was the right thing to drink, then they couldn't get it.
This is episode 15 of The Blender, the weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. You're listening to the story of our Ukrainian broadcaster Natalia Churikova, a story about fear, panic, and disinformation at the time of the 1986 nuclear disaster at Chernobyl.
There was really no expert advice on TV, but then the Soviet leadership realized that they need to go out and say something because the rumors already spread. And there would be experts or so-called experts who would come in front of TV and with a straight face explain that small doses of radiation were beneficial for rats' health. When they tested rats, so it could be beneficial for human health too. And there was a joke at that time that to the words, believe me as a minister, people should say, I wouldn't believe you exactly because you're a minister. but then it wasn't really a joke at that time because people were full of fear. The fear was everywhere. People didn't know what to do. They were given advice that they should clean their houses, that they should clean everything inside, that the dust collects radiation. And they even called the phenomenon radiophobia because people were really frightened of everything. They were frightened to eat, to drink, and there were really a lot of cases where people would just get some neurosis or some psychological disorders because of that. When we came home, and it was like in 2 or 3 weeks, I couldn't recognize the city. It was so clean. I've never seen Kyiv so clean before that or after that. So they were cleaning it maybe even twice a day, at least once a day. Big cars were going all around the city every day, washing everything away. Also, because people were so afraid to go to the marketplace and get the first vegetables, the first strawberries and everything, which would normally cost a lot of money and which would be the main income of the farmers at that time, that was all dirt cheap because people were afraid to buy that stuff. And especially later when the mushrooms started to grow, they said that mushrooms collected the most of radiation. The school year was cut off in May, so it was like months shorter than the normal school year. And the children from Kyiv and from the surrounding areas, they were taken away to so-called clean areas. They were taken away. Our school was taken to the Crimea, and we were put in a pioneer camp there for like 3 months, even more than 3 months. So it was cool for us. We did like that, to spend 3 months on the beach. But then again, all the people, the families who could afford it, who could who had someone, some relatives, some friends away from Kyiv, so they tried to send their children as far as away as they could. And many of my classmates spent at least first half of school year somewhere. My parents found a place as far as they could think of it, which was Tashkent, which was in Uzbekistan, several thousand kilometers away from Kyiv. But then there was an interesting phenomenon which we've never seen before or after, the Chernobyl children. The children of Chernobyl were invited by various international organizations all around the world, from Australia to Canada, from Italy to places like Cuba, where they would get medical treatment, and they would just spend several months maybe during the summertime to spend with the families or in the scout camps to clean the system from radiation. And that was the first time that these children would get the experience of the outside world. That's when the Soviet leadership couldn't keep all the Soviet children, Soviet people inside. So there is a whole generation in Ukraine of the people, of the children, who would get the first-hand experience of the Western world just through this campaign of Chernobyl children. It was the first time I went abroad when I was a student, and I accompanied already the group of Chernobyl children to Australia. But that's a different story.
That was our segment, This Is My Story, with Natalia Churikova, a broadcaster with RFERL's Ukrainian service. This man has probably one of the longest job titles in the Obama administration, but also one of the most challenging tasks. Gary Seymour is Special Assistant to the President and White House Coordinator for Arms Control and Weapons of Mass Destruction, Proliferation and Terrorism. He spoke with Irina Lagunina of RFERL's Russian service and Hossein Aryan of our Persian service, Radio Farda, about U.S. policy toward Russia and Iran.
It was mentioned several times, and Russia is very much praising the new spirit of the New Start as a spirit of partnership versus adversary, as it used to be. But it also looks like this spirit of partnership ends when it comes to the missile defense questions and tactical nuclear weapons. What kind of challenges do you see in this tactical weapons discussion?
I think there are big challenges because there's a disparity between the U.S. and Russia when it comes to tactical nuclear weapons. The U.S. has a very small number, only a few hundred tactical nuclear weapons, and we don't really have a strong military reliance on them as far as European security goes. In contrast, the Russians have a much larger number, probably a few thousand nuclear weapons, and they say that they need those tactical nuclear weapons to counteract NATO's conventional superiority. So in many ways, the two sides have a big difference of view in terms of numbers and mission, and that will complicate efforts to achieve any arms control agreement that includes tactical nuclear weapons. But nonetheless, it's been interesting. Since the Cold War, the Russians have certainly reduced significantly the number of tactical nuclear weapons they have. And as I understand it, they no longer deploy tactical nuclear weapons with their troops in the field. Instead, the weapons are in storage. So there may be some overlap as we now that we're no longer in a Cold War situation. And so there may be some room at least for greater transparency, which is where we think we need to begin, exchange of information on numbers, types, locations, to set a baseline so we can then begin a conversation about possible agreements for reductions.
That's exactly what I wanted to ask, because Russia is claiming that this type of weapons is in the storage, but there is no way to check it, and it's basically a unilateral claim.
Well, I think the first step is exchange of information, and we would be prepared to exchange with Russia information about numbers, types, and locations of U.S. tactical nuclear weapons if they were prepared to do the same about Russian tactical nuclear weapons. The next step is monitoring and verification, and that will require some very creative means, both technical and on-site verification. I think ultimately the two sides will have to talk about whether there are ways to allow access to storage facilities to verify that tactical nuclear weapons are not being removed. But that's an area that we're prepared to begin discussions with the Russians over what kind of access and verification arrangements we could design in order to verify tactical nuclear weapons. It's never been done before, so it probably will take some time to work that out.
How much of this discussion about missile defense is actually based on emotions rather than rationale, do you think?
Well, I think, you know, the Russian military remembers the days of Ronald Reagan and Star Wars, when they were very concerned that the U.S. was building a perfect defense that would negate Russia's strategic capabilities. And I think there may still be some elements in the Russian military that remember the days of the Cold War, that see the United States as the primary military threat to Russia, and therefore they naturally view missile defense as a threat to Russia's military capabilities. But from the American standpoint, we don't view Russia as an enemy. The purpose of missile defense is not to be used against Russian missile forces. We're much more concerned about Iran, and that really is why we're trying to develop missile defense.
Moving to Iran,
there seems to be a difference between the Obama administration and the Bush administration. Mm-hmm. While the Bush administration insisted on zero enrichment, the Obama administration is willing to talk to Iran and also go for sanctions and diplomacy.
Mm-hmm.
Has it worked?
Let me start by saying that the Bush administration said that once Iran satisfied concerns about its nuclear program, then Iran could have a peaceful nuclear program like any other NPT party. The Obama administration has said the same thing, but Secretary Clinton has gone a little bit further, and she's been explicit that once Iran has complied with the Security Council resolutions and satisfies concern, restores confidence in its nuclear activities, then it has the same rights as any NPT party. And in the NPT, there are no restrictions on the development of enrichment capability for peaceful purposes. So she has said explicitly what the Bush administration implied but didn't say explicitly. But both the Bush administration and the Obama administration has emphasized that the first step is for Iran to comply with the UN Security Council resolutions and restore confidence in its nuclear program. And what's remarkable is that of all the NPT parties, Iran is the only one that the IAEA is not able to report that it has confidence that the program is purely peaceful. And I think the ball is very much in Tehran's court to take actions that will convince the Security Council and other countries that its program is really peaceful.
What the United States is going to do to change Iran's behavior?
Well, I think the current Iranian leadership has been deeply committed to developing a nuclear weapons capability for many years. I mean, the current program started in the mid-1980s. After President Khomeini died. Mm. So I think what we're seeing is a political leadership in Iran, including former President Rafsanjani and obviously the current Supreme Leader, who strongly believes that having a nuclear weapons capability is important for Iran's national pride and national defense. So this is a long-term effort to persuade the Iranian leadership that they'll be better off without pursuing a nuclear weapons capability. And I think it's likely to take a long time to work. So President Obama has tried to use both the offer of improved relations to normalize U.S.-Iranian political relations, lift economic sanctions, work together on oil and gas development and nuclear energy if Iran is willing to address U.S. concerns about its nuclear program. On the other hand, since Iran so far has not been willing to engage in a serious diplomatic effort, either directly with the U.S. or in the context of the P5+1, President Obama sees no choice but to try to increase the cost to Iran's leaders of its nuclear program through political isolation and through economic sanctions. Whether this will work at the end of the day, I don't know. It may be that the current leadership in Iran is so committed to developing a nuclear weapons capability that all of the offers of engagement and all the threats of pressure and sanction simply may not be enough. The good news, though, is that Iran's technical capacity really has slowed down. I mean, they really have experienced enough technical difficulties, and secret projects have been exposed So all of that, I think, has given, in my view, has given the world some number of years to work on this problem before Iran is in a position where it could make a political decision to build nuclear weapons.
Some say that Iran is probably seeking not to obtain the actual weapon by itself, but to get the capability of producing the weapon. Does it actually make a difference from the point of view of non-proliferation?
I don't think it makes that much of a difference. In the first place, if Iran acquires a nuclear weapons capability or the option to develop nuclear weapons, I think the effect on Iran's neighbors will be very similar to if they acquired a nuclear weapon itself, because all of the neighbors will anticipate that Iran might decide at some point to exercise the option and build nuclear weapons, and they will feel compelled to follow suit, to develop their own capability. And in the view of the U.S., additional nuclear weapons capabilities in the Middle East is the last thing we need in a region that is already very unstable, full of conflict and tension and violence. So for us, and we think for the future of international security, preventing nuclear proliferation in the Middle East is one of our top objectives.
So could there be a military option?
Well, President Obama has said that the military option is on the table, but obviously that's not something that he finds an attractive thing to do. That's why he's trying to resolve this issue through diplomatic means. And I think my personal view is that if the cost of the nuclear program is high enough, it is possible for the leadership in Iran to decide that it would be better for them to make some compromises on their nuclear program in order to avoid the political and the economic risks of continuing with the program. But we won't know for sure whether that theory is accurate unless we can work together as an international community. And we've tried very hard to develop a closer relationship, especially with the big powers, especially with Russia and China, through the UN Security Council. And I think that's been effective. I think there has been some concern within Tehran about actions of the Security Council. For right now, though, I think everybody's attention is so focused on the Arab spring, on the Arab uprisings, that has probably pulled some of the attention away from Iran's nuclear program onto this instability in the Arab world. So that situation may have to settle down a bit before the nuclear program will come back into focus as a top priority.
This was an interview with Gary Seymour, a top advisor to U.S. President Barack Obama, on issues of arms control and non-proliferation.
З вами Радіо Свобода.
Це Радіо Фарда Кушніка.
Айче Радіо Європа.
Машал Радіо.
Азатить Радіосе.
Азатицюн ДТМ.
28 languages, 21 countries, one voice. Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty.
In our Meet the Bloggers segment, we introduce listeners to the correspondents behind the bylines. And this week's show, web editor Grant Podelko, who also hosts The Blender, finds out why Radio Free Europe needs a blog called Outpost Washington.
I'm here in the studio in Prague, and I'm speaking with Christian Karl in Washington. Christian is the chief Washington editor of Radio Free Europe and the primary force behind Outpost Washington, the newest blog on rferl.org, our English language website. Welcome to The Blender, Christian.
Hi.
The little blurb that you've chosen to describe your blog is scrutinizing the U.S. Capitol. Can you tell us a little about what that means and why the blog was created?
Well, the reason we started the blog is very simple. The way that the American media often cover events in America is very, very parochial and self-obsessed. It's all about us. And, of course, we here at RFERL have a lot of interesting knowledge about the rest of the world. We cover a lot of different countries. So we thought it would be very interesting to kind of counteract that self-obsessed view a little bit by bringing some of our regions to bear on the way that we look at Washington. So I call it turning the telescope around. Instead of looking at the rest of the world as this exotic, faraway place from the vantage point of Washington, we're trying to look at the policy process and the stuff that's happening in Washington through the filter of the way our regions are thinking about things.
Can you give me an example of something that works that way?
Well, for example, we recently published an English translation of a columnist who writes in a very widely read Pakistani newspaper, and he wrote an extremely interesting and very eloquent piece recently about how ordinary Pakistanis view the Pakistan-America relationship. And we were very struck by this piece, not only because it was very well written, but because it seemed to say something that you just really don't hear very often in the American media, which was essentially that for ordinary Pakistanis, it doesn't matter one whit whether Islamabad and Washington have good relationships and whether the aid money is flowing or how many CIA agents there are in the country. So we found that very refreshing, and we just thought we'd basically recruit that guy as a kind of guest columnist that day. And I think it brought a very interesting perspective to the blog.
You just mentioned the blog post from the Pakistani columnist. Are there some other posts that come to mind that you're particularly proud of? One of the things that that I enjoyed reading and which generated a lot of comment was the post that you did about the PSYOPs scandal surrounding, I think it was Lieutenant General Caldwell, who's now a commander of NATO in Afghanistan.
Exactly. I'm also very proud of that. I thought that was a lot of fun, and it made a very interesting contribution to the discussion. Of course, what happened was that an American magazine put out an article saying that contending that a U.S. general had actually used psychological warfare techniques on visiting U.S. dignitaries, including members of the Senate. And if this is true, it's going to be a very controversial thing, of course, and there's an investigation underway. But what we did on the blog was, first of all, we ended up publishing a letter by a number of the general's colleagues and subordinates defending him. And then we got Michael Hastings, the Rolling Stone journalist who wrote the original piece, to write his own response to that letter. And so we had a very, very interesting exchange going on there between the two sides, which I think, if you followed it, really clarified the issue very effectively.
Now, that was definitely a fascinating topic. Is there anything else coming up that we should be looking out for?
Well, I am in the process of writing a new post about an interview I just did with ex-UK Foreign Minister David Miliband, who is in the United States right now and who is pushing very hard a plan for what he calls a comprehensive settlement, political settlement on Afghanistan. And I had a very interesting conversation with him, and he has some very good ideas. But on the other hand, I think that his ideas reveal very clearly the pitfalls and the problems that lie ahead as the West tries to figure out some kind of compromise in Afghanistan. I thought he made a very, very eloquent case, perhaps the most eloquent case that you can make. But when you hear it, you also immediately think that, well, good luck. You know, it will be great if this works, but I'm not exactly holding my breath.
Right, right. Well, we'll definitely be keeping an eye out for that post. And thank you very much, Christian. You can find Outpost Washington, as well as our many other blogs, on RFE's English language website at referl.org.
That's our show this week. I want to thank our producer, Tanya Kancheva, and all those who were involved in making this podcast. If you have any comments, good or bad, please drop a line to the podcast at referl.org or leave a message on the Blender page of our English language website at www.referl.org. I am Pavel Butorin. Take care.